part we're not sure about.
Hello and welcome everybody to episode 32 of the In Tech We Trust podcast, coming live from VMUG in London the day after Tech Unplugged. And we've got a round table of legendary people, I think. But first of all, co-hosting with me today is Mr. Hans D. Len Herr, apparently, as he's just been announced in the VMUG introduction there. Welcome, though, Hans.
Hey, Nigel.
You've got a very professional setup going on here.
It's growing on us.
I mean, it is.
We've changed a couple of things. I think it's the second time we're now using this setup with the table mics. We used the first time in Milan, which was a lot better than previously using the Yeti.
Cool. Can I just ask for a very quick round of applause for Hans for actually organising this? No, I'm deadly serious. This is a very good setup. You've organised, you know, some great guests and a great introduction for the podcast as well in the VMUG there. So thank you, Hans. Well done. Yeah. Anyway, let's quickly run around the table. So first, Enrico Signoretti, legendary for organising Tech Unplugged now.
Wow, legendary is a very big word.
Thank you very much for having me today.
Pleasure. Julian, let's have an introduction too.
Yeah, I'm Julian Wood. I'm a blogger at wooditwork.com and an independent consultant who will work for anyone who pays me, really.
Very good. Welcome. Good to have you. Okay, and Ed, you're up next.
Hi, Ed Grigson, blogger at theexperience.co.uk, working for a cloud service provider in the Channel Islands.
And Mr. Stephen Foskett.
Hello, it's good to be here, Beck. You can tell that I am an English person myself here in London. I just found myself over here, so I figured I'd crash your podcast. I'm Stephen Foskett, and you can find me at Tech Field Day and blog.foskett.net.
It's good to have you, Stephen. You know where the loos are as well now, don't you?
Yeah, you take the lift to get there, right?
Yeah. I think they're behind the lift. All right, so straight on into some content then. Hans, you wanted to follow up on something from last week's show, didn't you, with regards to Coho Data and Docker?
Well, I think we did not really do them a good service in how we broke down the fact that they're merely an academic test and like a solution looking for a problem.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot more to that. It was to the news that they were going to do something with microservices containerized on their storage platform, which is frankly what I would love to see more companies doing, adding plug-in components into their storage. I think it is a really good thing going forward for them, this new type of architecture where they are able to, kind of plug in features more than built-in features like we used to see in big rollouts.
Yeah, I think, at least for me, one of the challenges with Coho is that while I do appreciate they've got shipping product, and on the topic of containers, I wonder if they're a little bit early, but just back to my point on Coho as a company, is it Andy that's the main guy there?
Andy Warfield.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Great guy, okay. Just has a tendency sometimes to go a little bit off the reservation when he's talking about new technologies and things like that, which sometimes distracts from the product. Coho do have a good product, and they are a very, very innovative company, in my opinion. But on the innovation front, I don't know if anybody agrees or disagrees here, but I just wonder whether what they're doing with containers and storage functions via containers on their kit is a little bit early. Because we talked yesterday at Tech Unplugged, what was the magic about Docker, right? And it was all about timing. Yeah, it's good technology, okay? It might not even be the best container technology, but it was timing and it was user experience. And I just wonder if with some of the cool stuff Coho are doing, they've not quite got the timing. Are they early to the party?
But don't you think that the fact that they are solving problems, at the end of the day, so if you have a problem with your storage, a problem that is not solvable with traditional tools, they have a solution. So actually, they are targeting a new market.
But what problems are they looking to solve?
Well, everything that is not solvable with a storage system, they adding intelligence on top of the storage system. Mm-hmm.
That's the future of storage, is to have more intelligence in storage. And I think another thing to think about is the fact, they may be early to market, but it's important to be early to market because storage must be mature. As we mentioned, as we brought up yesterday, you can't have a storage product that is not reliable. You know, the first rule You know, it has to. You have to not lose data. It has to be proven. By coming sooner, it gives them more time to be mature. So when the market is ready for what they're doing, they will have been on the market. They will be in GA for years. They'll be a proven platform instead of you know, a newer platform.
Yeah. So one of the things that I have mentioned in my presentation yesterday is the 5-year buying cycle, right? You buy your product, and the first year you're so much in love with your product. The second year you're still pretty happy with what you bought, but by the third year you're missing features. Well, there's two things that happen. You start missing features that you see coming in the market from other places, from younger startup, and probably your performance is not going to be the best. But that part of the missing features is that value that is now in Coho. They have the very flexible solution where they can add those components in, and I think that is something we missed last week.
So I'm nodding my head vehemently when you say that, actually. I do totally agree with that. But it's interesting, I think it was Chris Evans in his presentation at Tech Unplugged yesterday talked about intelligence moving out of the storage and higher up the stack, yet here we are having a conversation about adding intelligence back in close to the storage. Where do we stand with this? And is there one right way?
Yeah, but at the same time, Martin said that they solve many of their problems with scripts. So yeah, why not run scripts into the storage?
Okay. And yeah, there were people in the audience yesterday did say that, actually, weren't they? Can I get those scripts, please, Martin? And I want to run them in my storage. So that's cool.
Well, I just think you'll have a bit of both. I mean, even if in the long run you start surfacing stuff higher up the stack, you're still going to have a decade or whatever of having sort of more traditional storage, even if I'd put Coho in that bracket. So if you've got the option of, in that middle ground, adding some functionality in the storage array, great.
Are you saying you think the end game, though, is to have the intelligence higher up the stack and this is an interim?
It's kind of where I see it going at the minute, I guess. You know, I mean, we covered that yesterday again, divergence. There is more variety in the platforms you get. So for me, the flexibility, the choice of saying actually for some companies, whether it's central storage, scale-out storage, having extra functions sort of in that level versus going towards, you know, containers and distributed apps and them managing their own storage, it just gives you the best of both worlds. So I don't see them having a problem with it there. As long as it delivers value, that's the only thing for me is Coho can put containers in. It sounds really buzzy. It's going to get a load of headlines at a storage company using containers. But as an end user, does that actually help them get features in faster? Because that's the only thing it affects me.
Well, I think the containers for Coho is just an implementation detail as well. Honestly, who cares how they're adding their additional services on? If they choose to use containers, fine. But I don't think it's an about a containers thing. It just, they happen to have an architecture that you can use containers to add additional services.
Well, like I said, it's about the flexibility of adding future features. You ask about bringing more intelligence into the storage, which is exactly what we've seen with Data Gravity, Cumulo now, what Mark is doing. All those companies are not going to build analytics into the array. There is this question to how much more can we do once we store the stuff in that box. And I think there's going to be more and more intelligence coming into the box. And Coho has that flexible platform to be able to do that.
And if you think about in-place analytics, so if you look at the object storage, I love object storage, of course. And if you look at the object storage, most of the object storage vendors today are starting to talk about in-place analytics. So why not in that kind of storage?
I think there's a reason that they added containers, Nigel. I think it was to appeal to you.
Thank you.
And I don't think it worked, so unfortunately.
No, actually, it didn't work for me last week, but again, great conversations like this. I'm starting to change my mind. I'm thinking, you know what, maybe this probably is an enabler for them bringing features faster. I think it was you that said that. That's all you really care about, right?
Yeah. Adding value.
And I can see that, yeah. So if it adds value, yeah, good job. And containers are just an enabler for that, right? It can be something else next year. Who cares?
What we just discovered is that it is a good idea as an architecture. They just haven't managed to make it confident enough for everyone to understand.
Right, but I'll change my mind next week, yeah.
Yes.
One more thing quickly from last week's show. So as a follow-on from last week's show, we did another LinkedIn discussion, this time talking about whether or not NetApp are in a bad place and are they, you know, particularly badly positioned to compete against the cloud and things like that. If anybody around the table here has a comment on that, great. But just a big shout out and a thanks to everybody who's contributed again to the LinkedIn discussion, which has just been brilliant. It's a great way for us to interact and you guys to interact with us. And I don't want to say educate, but I mean, again, I'm reading through those comments and I'm wondering if I'm changing my mind as well.
We have acknowledged we're not really NetApp fans or fanboys on the show, the regular host. That's why we opened the discussion after after the recording onto LinkedIn. And there were a couple of NetApp ex-employees or NetApp resellers, integrators that stepped in and said, yes, NetApp has lost their angle for quite a couple of years, but apparently they would be back on track now with 8.3.
Yeah, I mean, underlying it all for me, though, is that 8.3, if it's good today, is a result of the Spinnaker acquisition however many years ago that was now. And it just makes me wonder, yes, we know they're on tap all the time, but is it a platform that's easy to adapt and to add new features and things like that to going forward? Because the world changes very, very fast these days.
Yesterday, most of the bloggers said the same thing. And the statement that I liked the most was flash and trash.
Yeah.
So we are seeing this divergence between very high performance block, flash probably, or hybrid, but mostly flash, on the high end, on the primary data, and all the rest with other technologies. And if you scale a lot, probably you need true scale-out modern architecture. I'm not saying object storage this time, but there are many options out there that are better than NetApp. And if you look at what happened yesterday, most of the attendees got NetApp as the bad example to show something wrong. Mm.
I've not seen much innovation from them. And I used to be a NetApp user. I've not sort of kept up with it for the last year or so. But whereas the other big tier one vendors have bought out companies and you've seen them acquire, some of the kind of the newer technologies and newer platforms that have come up in the last 3 or 4 years, I've not really seen much from NetApp. And I've always felt they've been a bit quieter than they should be. And you've got Nick Howell's podcast, there's stuff out there, but it's just there's less of it. But I have that same impression. It's ONTAP. And it's always been ONTAP, and the migration from 7 to 8 was not easy for anybody, and it just feels like they've been in a kind of a long locked-in cycle of we have to do this. And it's spun on too long, and the world has changed around them.
But I think that the pivot to the cloud, which NetApp attempted by having a unified ONTAP, was a great idea because you could have it from a VSA up to their biggest box and also running that in the cloud. So you could snap mirror on-premises into the cloud, job done. The problem is the world's moved on from there, and that's people aren't just snap mirroring workloads around. They want analytics. They want object stores. It's not just storing VMs. It's a whole mismatch of different kind of things, and NetApp took the decision, I think, let's go all in on cloud, and they partnered with AWS, whether that's a good or bad move or that's going to kill you based on recent announcements. And I think they were hoping that they were going to be the de facto cloud storage provider, but ultimately SnapMirror wasn't good enough. Applications are doing their own replication now. Who needs a NetApp?
Okay, great. Thank you, everyone. Let's move on to tech news from this week then. Very big week for VMware. First up, VMware adds DRAAS for databases in vCloud Air. Is there a way to pronounce that that's better than that? Is that
DR as a service.
Okay, fair enough. They added DR as a service for databases in vCloud Air. I did read the Register article on that. It was a bit of a meh for me. I don't know if anybody's got excited about that.
I don't understand the use case. I'm probably totally missing it, but I do not get the use case of this.
So shout me down here. Let me just summarize my understanding of it, which could very well be wrong. So you can now DR an on-premises database into vCloud Air and then spin up and run the database if you need to from vCloud Air. So if your on-premises data center goes down, you're able then to spin it up in vCloud Air. I don't know if there's anything special about that.
Sure. So you can have any kind of virtual machine on any service provider with MySQL, and you can replicate probably that.
That was my point exactly. I didn't. So isn't this something that every single database has solved themselves already in the application?
I think the point of this is VMware vCloud Air is playing serious catch up, and because they're an infrastructure player, trying to do some of the platform kind of stuff as well. But there's so many other applications further up in the stack that are doing replication. Now, VMware bought a company Continuant at the end of October, which they've now integrated. So they're buying in other companies to flesh out their cloud service. I think the ultimate goal from what they've said is their database as a service model, which will be instead of you managing a VM in vCloud Air with the database you then manage on top of that, they would provision all the underlying data, actual VMs, and you would just do the database stuff. I definitely think it's, yeah, other people have done that, but VMware, in order to be, I wouldn't even say a credible cloud vendor, but to be a basic cloud vendor, needs to have all of the stuff in, and they're going to have to be buying a ton of companies to bolster up their solution very quickly.
So this is just sort of moving a little higher up the stack for them, as in it's database aware, sort of its application integration versus just VM recovery. I haven't read the release, so I assume it's
basically clustered MySQL
use case,
either on-premises or in vCloud Air, and then replicating between the two. And I think it's got some extensions where it can now also replicate to Hadoop. I think that was something I read as well. So there's obviously stuff going on, and I'm sure they're hugely excited about it, but I think it's only bringing one little tiny part of the database replication market up to scratch to what everybody else is doing.
Speaking of super excited, I think they're probably super excited about the next thing that we'll mention. The bigger announcement,
I guess, or you are.
Yes, I am. The bigger announcement definitely from this week, though, was the announcement of Project Photon and Project Lightwave. Let me just summarize it for any listeners that may not be aware at the moment. This is my, again, interpretation of it. So Project Photon, VMware have released their own custom like micro Linux kernel, well, not kernel, but micro Linux distribution designed to run on top of ESXi for containers and for the cloud. And then Project Lightwave, access and identity management for said other product. Now, this isn't technical, right? But I thought the naming of this stuff was awesome because I first looked at Lightwave and I'm like, is light a wave or is light a particle? And it's both, and it's a photon particle. So we've got photon and we've got light wave. And just like the physics geekiness behind that, I thought was awesome. So a little micro round of applause just from me there. So well done, VMware. But actually, for me, the big thing about this, right, is that if I'm an enterprise, okay, I'm looking at containers and I'm thinking there are all of these startups and there are all of these startups doing like micro distributions of Linux and things, CoreOS and RancherOS and all these people, but I'm a bit scared to play with these guys as a conservative enterprise. Now, the old guard, and maybe we'll talk about Microsoft and NanoServer and things in a bit as well, but the old guard for the enterprise of Microsoft and VMware, not only are they getting that containers are important, okay, but I trust these guys, okay? And if I'm going to start putting my toe in the water with regards to containers, I'm probably going to go with the guys that I trust, that I've got support with, that I've got licenses with, that I've got guys on site that, you know, my own guys that have got VMware skills that want to get involved with this. I think this is a big thing for future enterprise adoption of containers.
Yeah. So my takeaway on that, we've been talking about containers for months and months now. Way too much.
No.
No. Well, but it's all like it's something in the future. It's for the ponytail programmer that is running it is running a big data center on 50,000 Linux machines, bare metal stuff. That's what containers are for. And this is in that use, it is never going to trickle down to the enterprise.
Right.
It will at a certain point, all these type of technologies do trickle down into some workloads, maybe not all, but into some workloads that are good for to run in enterprise apps. The only way it's going to be adopted by the enterprises as such, if it runs on the platforms that they trust. And we've had in 2-3 weeks, the Windows Nano server, and there was a couple of other announcements within Microsoft, together with VMware now announcing this whole thing, including the GitHub stuff.
Yeah.
And I mean, if that trickles down to the enterprise, you now already know that your main partner will be there to support you. that the transition doesn't have to be the Big Bang.
And that's huge, to have somebody as trustworthy as VMware or Microsoft, okay, to hold your hand doing something that's potentially as major as this.
Especially for the enterprises, yeah, right? Because yeah, well, they are so cautious about it.
But I think there are also some other things at play here that obviously VMware still very much needs to protect its VM infrastructure. And with this new Photon OS, why on earth is VMware creating a Linux distribution? Well, first of all, they know that Red Hat, Ubuntu, CoreOS run on physical machines, run on Amazon, run on all these other kinds of things. VMware needs to create, hopefully they think, a credible alternative that runs on VMware, because they're going to spin their whole story about VMs and containers rather than all.
Julian, just a quick question on that. It was going to be a question that I was going to ask later because I'm still not clear on this. The spiel that I've read around it so far is that it's optimized to run on ESXi. Will it only run on that platform, do we know? Can we not install this?
It's an open source Linux distribution. I'm sure you can do what you like, but I'm sure that whole support bundle and what you were talking about earlier, the comfort factor, is what VMware's playing on. To be honest, the world does not need another Linux distribution for containers.
Yeah, that's what
there
I was going to say.
Can never be enough distributions.
But VMware is going to create one because they're going to want to keep the enterprises happy. But to be honest, the enterprises are looking at Red Hat because they're there already, and possibly Ubuntu because Ubuntu runs 70% of the cloud, or maybe CoreOS because that for the real bleeding edge because they run on Docker. But I think what VMware is doing is also deliberately fragmenting the market. So enterprises are going to go, ooh, we're not sure where this is all going to play. I'm not going to put all my eggs in the CoreOS, Red Hat, or Ubuntu, or VMware market. I'm going to wait, and that will give VMware time to sort out something with either native containers on ESXi plus all the management. And I think this all gives VMware just that little bit more time they need to sort this all out so they don't cannibalize their own infrastructure or are able to pivot to the container world and not just VMs.
I totally get the business side of that angle where you're going for. I do want to ask, on the technical side, would it make sense for them? Are there technical reasons why building your own Linux distro, because it's going to run on ESXi, how can they differentiate from an Ubuntu? Can they make a better distro because it runs on ESXi than running Ubuntu on ESXi or any of the others?
In a way, you would hope not, because it means that then you can't run Ubuntu as well on ESXi, so ESXi is not a good platform suited for Ubuntu.
No, I don't think they can in answer to that, but that's just me.
Well, why not? I mean, they could easily do things. I mean, just off the top of my head, you know, like implementing or integrating VMware tools, you know, into the kernel and, you know, having instrumentation and support for things like that. I imagine that could be a positive way to spin what frankly seems to be a superfluous product to me.
Yeah, it just feels like a way of locking in to me. I mean, interesting, I disagree with the whole containers in terms of are they going to be massive scale uses and will it filter to enterprise? Because everything I've seen about containers is startups. And it's not being led by infrastructure in the least. Infrastructure is an afterthought. Nobody actually cares about it. We can all talk about it. We're all infrastructure guys. I just see being led by this whole DevOps, Agile. They might come and tell you they're doing it. You might get told you have to do it. I think it's good that VMware are hooking into it. So because at the minute there isn't a whole platform around Docker. So if that develops, great. You know, and that's where I think it's sort of a defensive play in a way. Mm. You've got Docker who already have got momentum and funding and hype. They're now building out a whole platform around the container and trying to get everyone locked into that, much the way as VMware did 10 years ago. They had the golden goose of the VM and then just built a platform around it. Docker are doing that. Rocket were late to the game, and then they're like, we've got a container. We think it should stay clean cut, but we need an ecosystem. Hey, we pair up with VMware. They've got an ecosystem. Everyone's happy, but I think a lot of people will just ignore the whole thing. So it's an infrastructure thing. They do VMs. We don't need any of it. It's open source. It's lightweight. We can pick any distribution we like. Why would I need that? Enterprises, I agree, will like
it. Yeah, so that is the whole point where this makes most sense. If you're not the I have one app on 50,000 bare metal Linux servers type of, that's where you could use the container stuff in I am the new eBay or I am the new Instagram or whatever. But if you are an enterprise and there is a use case for a 30% of your apps that could run on containers, and it would make sense to have a joint infrastructure platform for that.
And you have to consider that on the marketing perspective, they choose to call it an hypervisor. So if you look at the slides, they call the Linux distribution an hypervisor. And secondly, they are moving support contracts in time from the ESXi to another hypervisor. It's very comfortable for the end user because in the same budget from the same vendor, they will be able to move money from a product to another instead of changing supplier. It's very easy.
So it's got to be containers on ESXi natively in the next version because, I mean, hang on, Microsoft has announced containers on Hyper-V in the next version. Mm. I mean, Microsoft ahead of the game in hypervisor technology. Availability
well,
for Linux technology.
Yeah, but that's not available until 2016, right? I mean,
well,
that's in Hypervisor
VM, yeah.
V next. No, I agree. Yeah, but it's a long way out. So remember, what are we, April 2015? It's potentially 12 months away, so let's talk.
The thing I will say in VMware's favor for all of this is having this fragmented market means you still want to run virtual machines because there is no platform default de facto container standard yet that people are going to do. They may be running some Docker containers on CoreOS, some Docker containers on Ubuntu, for example, other Rocket containers, and unless you've got one container system, there's no point going physical machines because as soon as you've got different OSs and different things, you may as well run them in VMs because it gives you flexibility.
And you say it could be late 2016, but actually this morning someone asked who's running containers in his infrastructure and no one raised an hand.
Yeah, so that was hilarious. I just want to point this out to all of the listeners, right? So there was a shout out at the introductory session to the London VMUG this morning, and they asked quite a few questions. How many people are using vSAN in production? How many people were in the room, do you think? There's like 70 or 80 people in the room, right?
Easily. 120 probably.
Oh, 120 people in the room, let's say, right? How many people are using vSAN in production?
vSAN or server SAN. Right?
Okay, so, yeah. Right, yeah.
It could be another product. It was generic.
And I think, was it three or four? Five. Okay, right. Then they asked how many people are running EvoRail.
Or hyperconverged.
Or hyperconverged in production.
Or hyperconverged, which includes
and it was like five again, right? That's insane, surely. Yeah. And then they
asked one more.
Or NSX
SDN.
Or SDN.
Three or four,
right?
And then, the same ones.
And then
the
containers.
So hang on a sec. So I'm like having a right laugh at the back, taking photographs at the meager number of hands that are going up. And then he's like, how many people are using containers in production? Yeah.
How many was it?
It was an even number.
Yeah. Yeah. A very round number.
It was divisible by zero, right?
So you mentioned zero, Stephen. But can I just point out, right, we are at a VMUG.
Yeah.
Okay, if we were at a container mug, I'm quite sure the number would be different.
Yeah. Well, and to your point, the number of hands that went up asking for hyperconvergence, which is a mature product 5 years in the market now,
yes.
Right? And containers are not even at 1.0.
I want to come back just quickly to a couple of things that you mentioned, Ed. You talked about lock-in, right? That Docker are trying to lock people in just like VMware have, right? I do strongly disagree with that, and I'll say why in a second, but it's very interesting. We've talked many times on this podcast on the challenges around making money from open source, and we know that Docker just netted $95 million like last week or whatever, but between us, we still don't know how they're actually going to make money, right? And one of those ways would be maybe, okay, as the container runtime becomes commoditized like the hypervisor has been, you wrap it with payable services around that. But at least the way I look at it right now, Docker are anal about this batteries included but removable approach. So they'll like build something that's good enough so that when you just pull Docker down and distribute it within your enterprise, but you can rip just all of those parts out so easily and replace them with like Kubernetes or Mesosphere or whatever, right? So I don't think at the moment Docker are trying to lock people in. I do think in the long run they will have to when they answer to Wall Street and what have you. But it's still very much a company that's led by techies that are just mad about open sourcing everything. Mm-hmm. And that I'm sure they do care about making money. Of course, the CEO cares about making money. But just about everybody at Docker is still a code writer, right? And they're all just about the ecosystem and a cool product. And that's great, right? But they're going to have to make money.
How long
at some
does
point,
Docker
right?
have before it's too late for them to make a vast amount of money being acquired?
I'll make a bold statement here.
Unlike you.
If Docker gets an offer now from a Microsoft or anyone else that is decent enough, they should take it and run and not become the next Fusion.io. Because Fusion.io refused to take money and said, we're going to be the big boys of the world. And they failed miserably after a couple of years, thinking they were going to be the one and only player.
But who would buy them? I don't know who could buy them, because isn't the appeal of Docker very much that you can run it with anybody in a suit? I remember thinking ages ago, right, when I was like a storage-only guy, thinking, you know, why doesn't HDS, I remember thinking this, why don't they buy like Veeam or Commvault? And it was like, oh yeah, the whole value is that they're not tied to one of the big vendors, if you will. Now, EMC did an awesome job with VMware. I totally get that, right? And somebody could do the same, but I just don't, who would pick Docker up?
No, there's Red Hat.
Red Hat or Microsoft, for
but
that
suddenly
matter.
Suddenly it loses the appeal then. As a business, I genuinely don't know how it works in the long run. I mean, Red Hat are the poster child there, right? They're not taking the world by storm. They're doing great.
They're doing fine.
No disrespect to Red Hat.
But it does seem to be the ultimate home of every open source based right. business. Yeah. You know, Ceph, I mean, it seems like eventually, if you're going to be in the open source business as a business, you're going to be part of Red Hat.
Yeah.
Yeah, but EMC could very much buy it and fold it into the Pivotal family, which Cloud Foundry is, either way, pretty much the only de facto platform as a service that runs across every cloud, not just VMware, from Amazon to the whole lot. And that's apparently the most successful platform as a service. Containers as a service could be the most successful one based on Docker.
So there's two options. We could have Red Hat. We could have EMC, Pivotal, VMware, something like that. We could also have Microsoft. You know, that would be the other thing. And that would be a big departure. Yeah, it would be a big turnaround. But I think, frankly, that would be the most exciting outcome.
Yeah.
If Microsoft got into the open source, non-Windows, you know, I mean, that would be fantastic.
And there are some rumors about Microsoft open sourcing pieces of the operating system also.
Yeah, the nano server part of Windows, that would be pretty cool too.
They are a different company these days under Satya Nadella,
totally different.
Right? I mean, and for the better, right? Yes. Is there anybody that disagrees with that?
No. But interestingly, say from Satya Nadella, I think the whole pivot must have happened or even started under Steve Ballmer, because it's not just in 6 months, a year, that things change, but it's the messaging, I think, that has somehow come across, an embracement of open source, where that must have been on the books for years. You know, containers running in Windows Server is not something they just thought last week, going, oh, you know what, containers are going to be big, let's put it in the next version of Windows.
That's, well, it's not out coming out for another year, so maybe they did just think
year.
Of it. Yeah, I know.
I think the change happened from my perspective as somebody who goes, you know, met with Microsoft in Redmond, saw the company. I think the world changed despite Steve Ballmer, and the company was waiting to get rid of him, frankly.
And they were cloud first. You know, they built Azure and then are slowly trickling it to on-premises, which is the reverse of what
And they're getting market share there as well. Does anybody mind if I just go and jump around the room and sweat profusely and go, developers, developers, developers? Okay, let's just switch gears a little bit and we'll talk about some business news from this week. Really interesting numbers from IDC, I think, that 30% of servers, networking, and storage sold in 2014.
Was it servers? Yeah, just servers as such.
I know later on in the article they did talk about storage and networking, Tim, as well, but definitely the focus was on servers. 2014, 30% of server sales went to cloud-based companies. And I think if we delved into the numbers, they were particularly good for the likes of EMC and Cisco as well. And it looked like, from a growth perspective, right, year on year, that HP and Dell didn't fare so well.
Yeah, but the whopping numbers into those 30% going to the cloud were the ODMs. They are growing market share in that area. And I think HP and Dell and the others are not so happy about that.
But HP have just, well, let's say potentially come to market with their rebuttal to the ODMs, right? The white box guys.
Yeah.
And we talked about them like maybe last week or the week before. And the general consensus was that was a good thing, right? To take something like a ProLiant server, right? But that strip out all of the fancy wrapping that the enterprise would want. And you've got maybe a middle ground between something like a Cisco UCS or a high-end ProLiant and then Supermicro, right?
They are not the right guys in any case. So
HP aren't.
Yeah, HP. Also Dell. They have very cool servers. But if you try to rip the server apart and you get all the pieces, so you have a Supermicro. And the Supermicro guys are good at what they are doing.
But HP build Reliance into the server, so they're dual power supplies, RAID controllers, all that kind of thing. And to be honest, cloud applications that are self-replicating don't even need servers with a secondary NIC or a secondary power supply or memory that's self-correcting because, to be honest, if those servers have issues, just kill them.
Yeah, they don't care. If you think that when I met the Backblaze guy and they said... we go on our data center once in a month with a box full of disks, and we change all the disks one time in a month. So if something goes wrong, we don't care because we have so many servers and we can kill them and take them offline, and at the end of the month, we change everything. So everything is different there. It's not like we... So we care about our servers. They don't.
I think it was just for me, like, that the first big number, as in 30% of all the servers that are brought out are going into the cloud. That is a lot.
Yeah, and that number on the ODM as well, I can stand corrected on this, but I think it was something like 26. More than a 6 billion... Oh.
I think it's 26%.
Oh, right, so I was going to say a $6 billion market... That's a big number.
Yeah. It was a couple of billion-dollar market, yes.
And we imagine that's going to go north in the future,
but
right?
Who's the big winner in all of this? Who provides the processors to the servers, whether they're from HP, Supermicro, or the ODMs?
Intel.
Yeah.
Maybe ARM in the future, but Intel's just...
Yeah, now that's a very interesting discussion, actually, around ARM. Maybe we don't have time for that now. You know what I think is very interesting, though? We spent the first half of the podcast talking about how containers... from the cloud world and ponytailed developers, according to Hans, are trying to get into the enterprise in on the action there. And then now we're saying, look at HP and Dell and people like that that are all over the enterprise wanting to get in on the action with the ponytailed developers now. Stephen, just really something very quickly from yesterday, your presentation yesterday. You were talking about cloud, weren't you? Because we're talking about HP and Dell needing to... increased market share in the cloud and things like that. But you had a really interesting take on our perception of public cloud and private cloud in the future, and that we won't fuss so much over the difference between the two. Do you want to just...
Just in summary, my feeling is that very, very soon it's going to matter less and less all these distinctions that we've been making about public and private and hybrid and infrastructure and platform and all these things, and that we're going to get to a point where we just have applications that run in the cloud, and maybe you'll run them in Amazon, maybe you'll run them, you know, on premises, but it doesn't really matter, and that it's just going to be the new way of computing.
An interesting take. Thanks, Stephen. Appreciate that. And point all of the listeners to the Tech Unplugged website, where replays, video replays of all of the talks and different sessions from yesterday will shortly be available, yeah?
Yeah.
Stephen, you've just flashed your phone at us. I think most people are probably aware that at some point today, Amazon are going to be breaking out the numbers for Amazon Web Services. Now, we don't have anything on that right now, but potentially this is going to be, well, it's a massive announcement, mm-hmm. isn't it? It's going to give us all an idea as how much they're actually making, maybe how much they're, I don't want to say ripping us off, right, but milking us for. And the potential ramifications for the rest of the cloud, and especially the public cloud market, is going to be huge, right?
Yeah, the estimate is that most of the analysts in the space estimate that Amazon has about 50% of the cloud infrastructure market right now, and that the nearest competitor, Rackspace, has 8%. So we're going to find out pretty soon just how big Amazon's cloud market is, And that really could have massive, massive implications for enterprise compute as well. Since, as you just pointed out, I mean, you know, so many of the servers are going into that market, so many competitors, so many products and such development, it could be a real earth-shaking announcement. I wouldn't be surprised personally if Amazon announces a very surprisingly large number.
Wouldn't right. be surprised at all. And I think Amazon's very lucky that they run this vast retail empire, which has been able to mask their cloud, the AWS environment, because financial rules, you have to disclose if it's more than 10% of revenue. So we're expecting it to be more than 10% of their global retail revenue, which
they wouldn't be announcing this unless they had good news.
Until they had to, or were obliged to. So I think it's going to be massive, and I think it's going to really show how efficient Amazon is, because those figures are going to go out there, and then Amazon is going to be able to cut prices, and anyone else who isn't as efficient as Amazon is going to lose a lot of money.
Not only good news, but also with it being more than 10% of revenue, I think we're probably all anticipating that margins and profits in AWS may be considerably larger than the rest of their business as well.
Well, the analysts are actually pointing the exact opposite. They're saying that Amazon is probably going to show a loss on $7, $8, $9 billion of revenue, which because of their aggressive expansion and because they're still focused on growing, and that would be better news. Showing a loss of some few million would be better news than showing a massive margin.
Why? Because Amazon can deal with that and maybe Rackspace and the competition can't?
Exactly. Yeah. That Amazon, this is their traditional pattern, that they cut their margins, they cut their prices, and they don't worry about the margin, and they grow.
Yeah, they have a history of not actually really turning a great profit all the time, don't they, despite being like such a household name. And
do you think they've potentially deliberately increased their available infrastructure massively before this announcement?
Oh, yeah.
To show a loss, when potentially they're only running at 50% of capacity, because they know that they can ramp that up.
Yeah, because they only have to show the financial numbers. They don't have to show the capacity, the customers,
the utilization,
and so on, the utilization. Yeah, so I wouldn't be surprised, Nigel, if it ends up being a slim loss on a huge revenue.
Officially, the podcast can't comment on that, Justin, Julian. Can you imagine?
Well, we'll keep an eye on it for and make sure we cover it next week, whatever the news is that comes out today. By the time that we have edited and published our podcast, our listeners actually already know.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
A footnote.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see if it makes mainstream headlines, I think. Oh. Because Amazon's always, it's a bookshop, right? To the public. Everyone else in our industry knows it does more, but I wonder if that will actually go
into
mainstream.
Is it going to make the 10 o'clock news?
They do other stuff.
I think it will,
because
it's going to be, it's going to, the story, the lead is going to be, Amazon, did you know that Amazon rules the cloud? Did you know that Amazon is more than 50% of this, multi-billion dollar cutting edge industry?
That is a good shout, Ed. Yeah, I'd be curious to see how much mainstream news it gets.
And being at a VMUG today, I think it's going to show how far VMware vCloud Air still has to go
to get
anywhere.
Okay, guys, so thank you, everybody, for being on the podcast. Very interesting. No doubt by the time the podcast goes out as well, the Amazon news will already be out there, and we'll be talking about it next week. Be sure to track us on LinkedIn too, because we've been having some great discussions, and all we're doing there, right, is facilitating a discussion. The great stuff comes from everybody who contributes. We also have a special surprise for you.
Yeah, so don't run away. We'll be back after this jingle.
It's the people in charge we're not sure about.
So, Hans, speaking of people in charge that we're not sure about, we've got a very special guest, yes, but very special in respect that we just don't have vendors on the show. So, Joe Bagley, EMEA CTO for VMware. We really do trust you. But welcome to the show.
Hello.
Good to have you on. So, we've got you on because you've actually had some really cracking news this week that falls squarely into my ballpark, and I think quite a lot of the listeners. And it's even got Hans interested, and Hans hates containers. So, we'd like to talk to you briefly about Project Photon and Project Lightwave. Maybe give you the mic for like a minute or two just to give us a very brief and succinct high level what's the value of it and maybe why you're doing it, but
Not too long, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm not a sales guy. And that's not what I'm going to do. So why don't wear a tie? So really, the two projects, the important thing is they're both open source. And what we're trying to do is make sure that if someone wants to run containers, that vSphere is the best place to run them. That's essentially it. So the whole thrust is behind vSphere being, you know, containers being first-class citizens on vSphere. And one of the things that we've found that's really interesting as we've been exploring the container world for the last year or more, actually, we've found some things actually run faster on vSphere than they do on bare metal. And so a lot of the things are around, what do we do to optimize that further? But also it's more around a new direction for VMware, very much so, with this new Cloud Native Apps division and open source, which is also, I think, a big step and not something people are expecting from us.
Mm-hmm. Can you just briefly break down what is Photon, what is Lightwave, what is Lattice, what are the pieces of the news of this week?
Really, really simply, Photon is a cut-down, lightweight, built from the ground up Linux, specifically designed to support containers, that is optimized for vSphere. Lightwave is a lightweight, massively scalable, which was always the point from the start, directory service, and that authentication service also supports pretty much every open standard you can list in that world, including OpenID, Kerberos, and all those kind of things.
Can I ask a quick question that? Very brief. Is it a competitor to something like Active Directory then? Or is it does it complement or...?
It depends how you want to look at it, right? You could probably take it head-to-head against Active Directory if you really wanted to, but I'm not going to, you know, that's not what we're going after here. It's a secure LDAP directory that supports Kerberos. So is Active Directory, right? You know, that's about as far as it goes. We're a different architecture. We're focused on a different thing. We're focused on the entire infrastructure stack, specific features around container security in there as well. And more importantly, it's an open source thing, which is also, I think, you know, something to note about that. And so that's Lightwave. And then the last one really is Lattice. That's actually not a VMware project. That's a Pivotal project. Pivotal's another member of the Federation. Mm-hmm. And that product really is the orchestration layer, I would assume. You can read into for containers. And, you know, it sort of goes beyond. The nice thing about Photon is that we're not tying ourselves to Docker with Photon. We're supporting things like Rocket or RKT, as we're now meant to call it. And also Pivotal's Gardens as well. So.
Would it be fair of me to say that Lattice is something like Mesosphere or something, you know, maybe Kubernetes or something?
Yeah, it's all in the same sort of area, I suppose, yeah.
Yeah. Another quick question as well then. Since all three are open source, how come two of them have come out of VMware and only one out of Pivotal then? Because at least in my perception, Pivotal was that open. I would expect all three to have come from Pivotal, to be honest.
Yeah, I can understand why you would. I mean, if you wanted to look at it that way, you know, Pivotal's the open source guys, right? In fact, recently they've open sourced everything. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, we've done some open source too at VMware. It's just not been particularly well publicized. We can't go on without doing open source, I think, at VMware. So the important thing here is that if you look at it, Photon is so close to the hypervisor and so far down removed from the containers. I think it makes perfect sense for the company like VMware to be providing something like Photon. Whereas, you know, I would see Pivotal, if they're coming from the sort of Cloud Foundry angle down, you know, they kind of stop at the container. They, you know, they need containers. If you look at, say, Warden, for example, how that works on the back of Cloud Foundry, that relied on something called Bosch to actually build and operate the nodes because Pivotal weren't really into doing Bosch. Bosch was ours. So, you know, that's kind of where they draw the line. So it kind of makes sense for Photon to be there too. And with Lightwave, we've obviously had security and directory products for a while, you know, built into vSphere 5.5, built into vSphere 6, and it's kind of what you're seeing going forward with Lightwave. So, and it goes across the stack. It's just, you know, containers are included. Yeah.
Keep it for a minute at Photon. We did cover it in the first part with the other bloggers. What we thought, it is yet another Linux distro. The comment, I think it was Julian that made the comment. This seems like VMware dispersing the market a little bit and making sure there's plenty of choice. My question is, what is the added value that VMware brings to the table by bringing yet another Linux distro? Let me rephrase that question. Yeah. How much does your Linux distro Photon is going to run that better on ESXi than running an Ubuntu on ESXi?
So I suppose the best thing to think about here is that going forward, we're not actually bringing out yet another Linux distro, though it looks like that. And you think, okay, fine, what we're actually doing is we're trying to simplify things. So step back, think about the division, I suppose, that's in most organizations between developers and operations. Developers are going, we want containers. Operations are going, okay, fine, what do? Developers are going, well, I need some VMs, and we're going to start spinning up various different flavors of Linux, like Ubuntu, and we're going to spin up CoreOS and various other different things. And then the OS guys and in who are typically in the ops teams are going to go, well, hang on a second, that's two more OSs we didn't manage to today. There's a whole new patching regime. There's an update regime. There's a security management, et cetera, et cetera. What we're saying with this is, no, to support containers, you shouldn't have to have another layer to worry about. This, in terms of Photon, is going to sit with vSphere. It's going to be updated with vSphere in terms of security patching. And going forward, it will ultimately become part of something that ships with vSphere as well. So it's not going to be something separate on top from a different, you know, angle or however you want to look at it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense, yeah. I do have a question, though. Mm-hmm. Is it possible to take Photon and run it on bare metal or on another hypervisor?
No.
It's tied in to ESXi.
So it's tied into ESXi in terms of we've optimized it for ESXi. And essentially what we've done is we started from scratch, built up a distro of our own Linux distro that's optimized for our hardware, our virtual hardware, if you want to look at it that way. But it's open source. So at the moment, there's no reason why someone else couldn't take it, you know, do a pull and go and start building optimizations for it to run another hypervisor or bare metal. But that's not what we've built it for.
What would limit that today? What would be the limitation of not being able to do that or being able to do that successfully, running it on bare metal? What would limit that?
I don't want to answer for it.
I
think, to be honest, I mean, if you understand what we've done, and you can probably understand quite clearly what you have to do to then get it to work on a different platform. It's just a case of looking at the driver sets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and updates and things like that as well. You'd have to look to see how you could break those out and do them yourself manually. And
yeah, and also don't forget we support both RPM and Vim as well in what we're doing here to make things a lot easier for people.
Right.
And you can get it in various different forms as a way to, you can pull it from Vagrant. There's a whole bunch of different ways we're trying to make this available to people. We want to make this thing simple, easy, the operating system you run underneath your containers should be as non-differentiating as anything else, right? So it's just get on with it, because what you're doing in the containers is the interesting piece if you're a developer, right? So I think that's really the point, and we're giving them, you know, that kind of functionality. So it's just, you could sit there and make arguments until you're blue in the face, and I have this a lot where people go, oh, well, you know, but if I go and get this particular build of Linux and I go and run it on bare metal, it's going to be so much faster than you running it. And you're kind of like, yeah, what magical world do you live in where there is no legacy? What world do you live in where you can walk into an existing enterprise or organization and go, yeah, you know that lovely data center you've just spent the last 3, 5, 7 years completely virtualizing, optimizing, and everything else? Well, we're going to build a new silo in the corner. Right, a new style of legacy for you, if you want to put it that way, which is going to be bare metal with a whole different management regime, everything else. That's why we have ops guys coming to us all the time crying out, how do you virtualize that? Can we need to virtualize it? So we had it with Hadoop. With Hadoop, people are saying, I sat with CIOs not far from here of large banks go, or heads of infrastructure going, I'm being asked to build silos of metal for Hadoop. What do you do? So we worked hard, Project Serengeti, we worked out how to get Hadoop to actually run faster and better virtualized than physical. And if you look at some of the stuff, if you just Google Docker VMware Redis, you'll get a link to the blog on the CTO page where we've done some testing with various different things. One of them was Scale Out Redis. Turns out Scale Out Redis runs faster in Docker in a VM than it does run on Docker on bare metal. Why? Because of the NUMA optimizations that we do and various other things. And so if you look at what we've done in that hypervisor, which is an operating system, it's a very, very highly tuned kernel. I mean, incredibly highly tuned kernel. What we're doing is, you know, those things, that's not only the security separation, but the performance tweaks and enhancements we've done, we're making them available to containers. So let's, I know I'm going on here, but one good thing, but VM Fork, right, which technically is now called...
Is this the old instant clones thing?
Okay. Well, it's instant clones, right? So one of the things that's good about containers is that you can fork, you know, 50 of them in a fraction of a second. You can do that with VMs now. vSphere 6 does instant clone. You can fork, you can quiesce a VM and fork 50 or 200 of them if you wanted to. Now, Think about that not in the context of VDI, which is where most people seem to read that one. Now think of it in the context of containers. Mm. Think about the fact that instead of running multiple containers per VM, I'm running one container per VM, because from a management perspective, that's possible. Not only that, I get optimizations and all the security separation and managing everything else because I'm running one. And if I want to fork it just like I would do within its native OS, bang, I've got 200 of them, except they're in VMs, which actually gives me better separation, better control of networking, a whole bunch of different things that you wouldn't get if you forked within one single OS. And also the advantage of all of that performance, contention handling, and everything else that we've already got built into the hypervisor.
Am I not understanding? Because I am absolutely not the container guy, right?
Oh, yeah.
That's why I have to ask the newbie questions.
That's cool.
Am I not misunderstanding that a container is something that is deployed and not clones, and that you deploy the stacks on top of that?
So there's various different ways to understand containers, but essentially, just imagine that instead of running a virtual machine on the metal basis, so you're literally emulating a whole virtual machine, a container is virtualization at the OS level. In, I suppose, without wanting to get too technical, it's you're sharing an OS. All right, it's just so think back to terminal server.
Yeah, it's an ability to carve up an operating system's resources and run multiple apps without them trotting all over each other. I wonder whether you're getting hands at the layered nature of containers and the fact that if you've got, let's say, an Ubuntu Docker image on your Docker host, and you can launch 50 containers based off of that, and they all consume just the space of one, right? Yeah. Until you start making changes at the top level.
But everything that I have seen is that it doesn't stop at that level. It's always in a template where there's the solution already on top of that you build it.
Yeah,
right? You can't do that really from a clone, right?
So let's look at why Docker was so successful. Docker was so successful mainly because it was incredibly easy for people to use, number one. But more, what they actually invented was kind of a standard for containers that they didn't exist at that point, because there's been various different ways of doing containers for years. Back from when, you know, the Ubuntu guys started with LXC, but you can go further back than that through
Chroot,
you know, BSD,
yeah.
Chroot, BSD, you've got jails, you've got, you name it, WPaaS, the whole lot. They're all the same thing. What Docker did was they made it really simple, and what they essentially invented was what we did with DMTF with OVF. So you've got OVF for VMs, right, which is a standard for VMs, which meant that you can take a VM and move it. No one really uses OVF because there were so many optimizations made, and it got a bit, you couldn't quite loosely couple as much as that, but we support it, and some others don't. Docker is that level removed, and so you can run on Ubuntu version of Docker and hopefully, arguably, take that Docker container and then go and spin that up on, you know, a core OS version of Docker. What's happening now is that's starting to drift, as I'm sure still, you know, it's not quite being that clear cut. But just think about the fact that instead of having a VM that contains the operating system and the app, now a container is something that just contains the app because it's running on a shared operating system. So Parallels, Virtuoso containers, Terminal Server is something that maybe your listeners would probably have more of an understanding of how that worked to them. Mm-hmm.
So on the topic of standardization and things like that, mm-hmm. you support Rocket, Docker, and Garden.
Yep.
Okay. Are they all first-class citizens?
Yep.
Yeah. And do you have a favorite? Do we see one being preferred over the other going forward?
Not really, to be honest. I mean, they're all launched. Well, they've all been speaking around our launch. CoreOS were actually the launch event, etc. So, and obviously Pivotal were as well. So, no, there's no one over the other. It's in our interest to support as many as possible.
Okay. And are you behind the app container specification?
Can't comment on that.
Okay. All right. Do you ever see going forward that the Linux functionality that's in Photon at the moment ever drifting down into the ESXi kernel itself and then taking that extra layer away?
I can't rule that out.
Okay.
Can I do my maniacal laugh now? Is that?
Yeah. Hey, here's one more quick question as well. Going forward, and maybe you can't answer this either, do you see containers being as big in the enterprise as VMs are today ever? Or do you see
side by side or by replacement?
Right. Short answer to that.
I see side by side.
Short answer to that, yes, side by side. I don't think it's going to go quite as quick as people think, because if you look at why VMs are used because they support practically everything, and most ISVs will deliver you code that will run in a VM. There's not many ISVs that will deliver you code that runs in a container. A lot of the talk here is about developers. How many customers out there actually have developers? It's a very small number if you look at the big picture. So how many enterprises are big enough to have their own development team that actually can take advantage of containers? Not many. So I think when you start to see people like ISVs shipping stuff in Docker containers, then maybe I think you'll see a greater rise in it across the board more generally. But I think it's something to be aware of.
Yeah. Would it be fair to say that within an enterprise, net new, cloudy stuff might go down the Photon route, and our traditional oracles and exchanges and things like that would be still the choice in a traditional virtual machine going forward?
Yeah, and in fact, that's our challenge, right? Because if I was starting up a new cloud company today, I could go out and build the most amazing container platform and everything else. But actually at VMware, I've got to support everything from DOS 6.22 up to and including, you know, containers, essentially, so microservices-based architectures. We do actually have someone running a DOS 6.22 VM on vCloud Air right now. It's their door entry management system. So, yeah, I have to support all of that, chickens and kittens.
Okay. So one last question, maybe. If I deploy Photon going forward on top of ESXi and I deploy containers to it, if there are then orchestration tools out there that say, you know, allow me to spin workloads up in AWS or in Azure and things like that as well, is there anything about the ESXi and Photon combination that would say any containers and workloads and apps running there would not be portable to somebody else's cloud?
I would emphatically hope not,
okay,
right? Because that's not in our interest to do so. Because if I make you sticky to our platform, it doesn't mean that, well, it's a couple of things, right? One, you can't leave very easily, but two, you also can't come to it. The more open I make my platform, the more chance I've got of actually people coming both ways.
Magic.
That's a great closer.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
No
Appreciate
problem.
Your time. Good luck with the project.
Thanks.